Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Richard, and I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Carlyle Group, Manhattan, and chair of New York's Intergroup Steering Committee. It's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight on behalf of Intergroup Steering Committee. Since there may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level, I'm going to read the AA anonymity statement. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker, or indeed any AA member, be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. Our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. In the spirit of this tradition, we ask that photographs not be taken in this room. Since the meeting is being audio taped, we also ask that speakers refrain from using last names. Next, I'd like to introduce those seated on the dais. First, I'll introduce those seated on the lower dais. Beginning from your right. Please hold your applause until all those seated on the dais have been introduced. From your right, Nicole D., Steering Committee Secretary, Steve G., guest of Sandy G., alternate chair of New York Intergroup's Steering Committee, Jerry G., chair-elect of All Areas Institutions Committee, Denise M., Brooklyn Area Representative, Joe N., Queens Area Representative, and his wife, Mary, Brian O., chair of the Public Information Committee, and his guest, Marta, Robert C., chair of the Group Relations Committee, Sheila A., wife of Shelley A., Manhattan Area Representative, Adrian B., guest of Hermina J., Bronx Area Representative. Oh, the light's back on me. Can't see a thing. And now I'd like to introduce those seated on the upper dais, again, starting from your right. John D., one of our speakers, and his guest, Dana. Richard H., husband of Francine H., one of our speakers. Bob H., guest of Reverend Mary H., myself, Richard. Ken O., chair of the 1998 Bill W. Dinner Committee, and his brother, Walter. Steve M., who will lead the candle lighting, and his guest, Antonella, Father Jim F., Abu C., one of our speakers, Ann M., guest of Bob R., Executive Secretary of New York Intergroup. And that's the dais. The dinner committee has asked me to make the following announcement, which is also printed in your program. The dinner committee respectfully requests that guests refrain from cigar and pipe smoking in the ballroom and from cigarette smoking while food is being served. Thank you. Now I want to introduce to you someone I just introduced a moment ago, and that is Kenny O., chairperson of this year's dinner.
Howdy. Good evening. My name's Kenny O., and I'm an alcoholic. And to say I'm nervous is the least. Before coming down here tonight, somebody asked how I feel. And I said I feel great. The reason I feel great is because I am an alcoholic. I go to meetings and I don't drink. And I am really nervous. Before coming down tonight, I went to the dictionary and they looked up the word love. And they quote back with see banquet room tonight. Because there's a lot of love in this room tonight, and I can feel it. And to get on, good evening, friends and family. My name is Kenny O. I'm an alcoholic, a member of the St. Paul's group, Staten Island, the best group on Staten Island. Welcome to the 1998 Bill W. Dinner, and thanks for supporting our New York Intergroup. This year we are celebrating Intergroup's 52nd year of service in New York Fellowship and the 64th sobriety anniversary of AA co-founder Bill W. By your presence here tonight, you show the support of New York Intergroup and its many varied services of AA members and from suffering alcoholics in the greater New York area. Intergroup publishes meeting books indicating nearly 115 groups, including 4,000 meetings each week. Volunteer AA members carry the AA message by telephone every day through the year. Four members are available in three daily shifts after 10 p.m. Volunteers take calls at home to 2 a.m. from the Sunday through Wednesdays and through night of other times. We hope to have lines open 24 hours a day soon. Members of Intergroup's Institution Committee are responsible for more than 550 AA meetings every week in detoxes, treatment centers, prisons, and shelters all over New York City and Westchester. Last year, more than 10,000 students in New York City and Westchester schools heard about alcoholism and AA program from members of Intergroup Public Information Committee. The committee also carries AA messages to senior citizens throughout the city. The proceeds from tonight's dinner dance provides 15% of the New York Intergroup's annual budget. So your presence here tonight is important, but Intergroup needs more support every day of the year in order to self-support through our own contributions 365 days a year. So please carry the Intergroup message back to your home group. It's an honor to serve as chair for the Bill W. Dinner Dance, but the event happens because of the committee of many AA members. Especially I want to thank the dinner committee, who have been working for almost a year with me, making this event a successful one. And the committee that worked with me for over a year is Arlene, John, Greg, Pierre, Barbara, Katie, John, Kathy, Jean, Brent, Dennis, Patty, and Sylvia, and Marianne. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being there for me. Thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce Father James S. from the Progress Group, Queens, to offer the invocation.
Dear God of our understanding, we are here tonight to honor our co-founder, Bill W., on this, the 64th anniversary of his sobriety. As we often like to say with a smile at our regular AA meetings, we are all here because we are not all there. It is true, but we are no longer afraid to look at our defects of character or shortcomings because we have surrendered to our powerlessness over alcohol and have turned our will and our lives over to you, a power greater than ourselves. One noted author has described the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous as the greatest gift that our higher power has given to the 20th century. This millennium is about to close. It has been marked with wars, terrorism, and crime. We are very familiar with these events because they were once part of our everyday lives and of the lives of our loved ones in a brutally destructive manner. Into this world of self-loathing and grandiosity has come the simple yet profound solution proposed by Bill and Dr. Bob. Share your experience, strength, and hope with one another, and you will learn how to get sober, stay sober, and to live a productive life filled with reasonable happiness, joy, and freedom. An immense number of years of recovery from the disease of alcoholism is present in this dining room tonight. We, over whom many members of our families, relatives, and friends threw up their hands in futility and disgust because of our outrageous behavior, now open their arms in warm embrace because they see us as changed. Yes, we have been healed by our higher power. In body, mind, emotion, and spirit, we have been reborn. We thank you, Bill and Dr. Bob, for giving us back our lives. It is right for us to honor you at a meal, a most beautiful sign of fellowship. In each and all of us is woven a collective story of defeat turned into victory and of humiliation turned into triumph. And perhaps the most obvious sign of our exhilaration is in our ability to laugh at ourselves with one another and to wear the world like a loose garment. O higher power, we thank you for inspiring Bill W. in a moment of panic that threatened to jeopardize his newly found sobriety simply to pick up a phone directory and track down another drunk with whom to share. Together, they both rose from the ashes, and so have we, one day at a time, for the 64 years in which our fellowship of AA has grown and continues to flourish. Bless this delicious food and ourselves. May we hand on to others this priceless gift which has been entrusted to us. Amen.
Kenny Olsik, and I am an alcoholic. And I hope you enjoyed the dinner. And with that, we're going to get along with the meeting. As you see on the table in the program, I think it's the theme of this year of Bill W. dinner is AA Singleness of Purpose. And I'd like you to take a moment to think. Because there hasn't been a time when either somebody was 12-step or somebody planted the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous in your head. And that's where we came up with the theme, AA Signals of Purpose, is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The seed was planted over 10 years ago by the gentleman on my right, who's my brother Walter. He went into AA up in Massachusetts. And the first meeting he went to, he won a big book. And he called me up. He was so happy. And he says, you know, I won a big book. And he says, you should read this book and you should go to meetings. And I told him we could do it with the big book and you could go to meetings. And sure enough, I believe it's a family disease. I came in a year later, and I haven't gone out since. So I'd like to take this time to thank you. Thank you, Walter, for doing that for me. And now I'd like to go into the reading of Bill's last. Bill W. had his last drink in 1934. Tonight, we gratefully celebrate what has been Bill's 64th year of sobriety anniversary. 64 years. We also celebrate what we did with his sobriety. He did not keep it to himself. He passed it on. And that's what this is about, this meeting, is to pass the message on. The chain reaction from the 12-stepping has spread the light of AA to millions of alcoholics around the world. And the 12 steps work has continued every day for the past 52 years at our own New York intergroup. For many years, Bill W. Widow Lewis, the founder of Al-Anon, celebrated this evening with us. Lois died October 5th, 1988, having lived 97 full years. We still miss her. Each year, Lois read to us Bill's last message to his fellowship. Tonight, Bob Orr, the executive secretary of New York Intergroup and a member of the 79th Street Workshop in Manhattan, will continue that tradition. Please welcome Bob Orr.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. Bill's last message. My dear friends, recently an AA member sent me an unusual greeting, which I would like to extend to you. He told me it was an ancient Arabian salutation. Perhaps we have no Arabian groups, but it still seems a fitting expression of how I feel for each of you. It says, I salute you, and thank you for your life. My thoughts are much occupied these days with gratitude to our fellowship and for the myriad blessings bestowed upon us by God's grace. If I were asked which of these blessings I felt was most responsible for our growth as a fellowship and most vital to our continuity, I would say the concept of anonymity. Anonymity has two attributes essential to our individual and collective survival: the spiritual and the practical. On the spiritual level, anonymity demands the greatest discipline of which we are capable. On the practical level, anonymity has brought protection for the newcomer, respect and support of the world outside, and security from those of us who would use AA for sick and selfish purposes. AA must and will continue to change with the passing years. We cannot, nor should we, turn back the clock. However, I deeply believe that the principle of anonymity must remain our primary and enduring safeguard. As long as we accept our sobriety in our traditional spirit of anonymity, we will continue to receive God's grace. And so once more, I salute you in that spirit, and again, I thank you for your lives. May God bless us all, now and forever. Ever yours, Bill.
Now I'd like to introduce the candle lighting. Friends, the candle lighting is a tradition part of the dinner program. During his lifetime, Bill W. led the candle lighting, symbolizing the AA message being carried from a sober alcoholic to a suffering alcoholic. Please be prepared for the candle lighting with a lighter or a match. Tonight, we ask Steve M., a member of the Sunnyside Group, Staten Island, to lead the candle lighting. Please welcome Steve.
I'm Steve, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here tonight. Hey, y'all.
I get a laugh out of it, too.
Best leave the house. Quoting Bill W., leading the candlelighting ceremony on October 7th, 1967. This is a time for grateful and happy remembrance. And on these occasions, I particularly like to remember my first partner in this undertaking that is AA, Dr. Bob, in whose house I was sheltered when the first AA group was born in Akron in the summer of 35. Up to then, it had seemed that the light had shone, but that the candle was flickering and that it might go out. It was then that I met Dr. Bob. The scene comes back as though it were yesterday. I'd been down there in the lobby of that hotel, having failed in another business enterprise that had so much promise. Nothing happened. I began to fear for my own sobriety. And through the providence of one of our first friends, Henrietta Sieberling, I met Dr. Bob. And I can see Dr. Bob and his wife, Anne, as they stood in the doorway that afternoon. Dr. Bob was shaking. He said He couldn't stay but a little while, and I said, "Well, I guess that means you're thirsty." Henrietta discreetly put us into the library, and there we began to talk. Up until then, I feared I had been preaching, I had been exhorting, and I had been persuading. But now that I was in danger, I knew I needed this man, drunk or sober, just as much as he needed me. It was then that what we know now as the language of the heart, spoken and unspoken, began to be a reality, and something passed between us. And there was a fusion, and the candle was passed to Dr. Bob. I remained in Akron for 2 or 3 months that summer, living with Dr. Bob and Ann, and helped him as he passed the first candle to our first prospect known in AA as the man on the bed. And he got up and took his bed and walked. And he went back to the arena of life. And though he had been in that hospital 6 times in the previous 4 months, AA number 3 was never to drink again. And the first AA group had been formed. The passage of the illumination hand to hand is symbolized by the candles. There's been no greater exemplar of that than Dr. Bob. Surely, it's the least we can say when we declare him to be the principal of 12 steppers. And you'll remember how, in succeeding years, he and that frail but wondrous nun, Sister Ignatia, carried the AA message to 5,000 alcoholics in Akron, Ohio, and its environs at St. Thomas Hospital. I think it's fitting to recall this, because from Dr. Bob took off uncounted succeeding generations of AA. Had he and a score more of old-timers not kept the faith, we would not be gathered here tonight. In remembrance of him and of those who labored in our pioneering time, members and friends alike, I will now light a candle and pass it to the first table, and will each table in turn show its own illumination. Of Dr. Bob and of old-timers throughout our fellowship, may we bow our heads in a moment of gratitude in which the language of the heart can be passed between us without a sound. Amen.
Good evening. And for those who know Steve, those are the shortest minutes he's ever spent speaking. I like to do the preamble tonight. But what I like to do is ask us all to do it together, because this is a We Me fellowship. So those who would like to join in, please do. We're reading in the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve the common problems and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied in any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes in any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Thank you. The last sentence, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And that's why we're here tonight. Still nervous. And these are the fewest words I've ever said in a while, too. I'd like to introduce our first speaker, John D. Morris Group, Park Group from the Bronx, John D.
Hi, everyone. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I guess that light's going to be on me the whole time. Anyway, it's really good to be here. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to speak. And I don't know if anybody's here from the Bronx. I was looking around to see. Okay. I just can't recognize you in suits, you know. Okay. Anyway, I'll get right to my story. I've got about 20 minutes, so it's the... I've got a very long story. I drank alcohol for about 30 years. I was born in White Plains, New York. My family gave me for adoption at birth. Never met them. I always thought it was my fault. I didn't know why that happened. People would ask me like I knew, you know. So I didn't make up stories. I don't know. They just, you know. I was shuffling around a little bit, orphanages, stuff like that. Nobody has nothing to do with alcoholism. But I ended up with a family in the Bronx when I was 5 years old. And those people, they were not alcoholic. They were very loving and caring. And I had my first drink at 5 years old. My father had a bar in the basement. And I remember he was building it. I thought he was building a toy. I remember this big construction, you know, high seats. I didn't have any idea what it was. In the Bronx where I'm from around a little further up than Gun Hill Road and that section of the Bronx. Between Gun Hill and Eden Wall Project. So if you know that section, that's where I'm from. And when I grew up some years ago, everybody had grapevines in the backyard, grape trestles. Everybody made wine, and my family made wine. And I remember as a kid, I used to be putting barrels to stomp the grapes. And I was having such fun doing that. You know, it was real cool. And so my family had big vats in the basement of wine, and I developed a taste for wine as a kid. I never considered wine alcohol. I never saw too much alcohol. Alcohol was behind the bar on the shelves. And a couple of times a year, my father would have poker games or something going on in the basement, and have his friends came over. I'll tell you a little bit about my parents. I'm mixed. I'm from mixed parents. I'm part Italian, part Spanish, part black. My foster parents are black. And so growing up in my neighborhood, it was real hard. It was an all-Italian neighborhood. My parents were black. I know when I came, not until I came to AA did I ever hear anybody that I identify with in terms of not fitting in. And I didn't fit in at five. That's how I felt. And all these questions were always asked me about stuff, you know, and I didn't have the answers. I used to think that, I don't know, maybe you learned it in school. When you went to school, they gave you all the answers for all the questions. And I didn't find it in school. I don't think I've ever found it anywhere. My first drink. I didn't want to tell you about my first drink. 5 years old, first drink. I did three things when I was 5 years old. I think they're significant. I'll tell you about all three of them. One of the things, I used to be in my room. My family was kind of old. They were in their late 50s when I went to live with them. So it was like growing up with grandparents. And so my father worked three jobs. He worked for the post office. He owned the barbershop, and he owned the gas station. He learned those things in the service. He had that strong work ethic. And he was always out working or home sleeping. My mother also worked, so I was kept with people in the neighborhood. Old people with pianos. That's all I remember. So I used to play in my room. I was always in my room. In these days, children was to be seen, not heard. So I was in my room playing. And it was nothing dreary. It was not like it was today. Nothing in my room but my bed, my window, and walls. And I used to sneak into the bathroom. That was like a big thing, to sneak out of my room into the bathroom. Why, I don't know. I wanted to sneak in the bathroom, but it was like another room in the house. And I used to sneak in the bathroom. And at 5 years old, I thought I found where the family hides the chocolate at, in the medicine cabinet. You know, because I found a box of chocolate in the medicine cabinet. Which that's it. That's where they hide the chocolate. And I ate. And, you know, I tell you, I know about you were alcoholic long before we pick up the alcohol, because I ate that whole box of chocolate. And I just want to tell you, from that day to this day, I've had no more ex-lax. Another thing I did when I was 5 years old that was pretty significant, playing in the room again, one of my mother's bobby pins, I found a bobby pin, probably in the bathroom, because that's the only place I went, and I stuck the bobby pin into an electric socket. And I need to tell you, from that day to this day, I've stuck no more bobby pins in electric sockets. And I also had a drink of alcohol, and fortunately or unfortunately, it set off the obsession, I think, when I was a child. Not the physical compulsion, but the obsession, because I couldn't wait to drink again. And my first drink was going down to the basement to clean up one of those parties that my father was having, and I took a bowl of pretzels and popcorn, because that's all I was always down there for, and I decided to take everyone's leftover drink and put it in a vase. And, you know, leftover drinks, I mean, I never saw nobody drinking. I mean, everybody had a drink in front of them when I was gambling, but nobody really drank. I never saw anybody drunk or any of that. You could tell the drink would be one color, and by the time they left, it would be another color from the ice melting. That's how much they drank. They didn't drink a lot. And so I had half a vase of booze. I filled it up with some old granddad. That's my, that was my drink of choice, if you have one. And I took it up to my room. I ate the pretzels and the popcorn, and I started drinking this alcohol. And I drank this alcohol so I could drink no more. It wasn't like one sip or something like that I drank. I tried to drink half that bottle. No, I didn't. But and I remember crystal clear, like it was yesterday, how all of a sudden my room turned into a gymnasium. And my bed became a trampoline, and I was jumping up and down. I was in the Olympics, and I didn't know what the Olympics was. And I was just having the greatest time in the world in my room. And then I got sick. It's funny, I didn't notice I said this, but I got sick, and I was always thinking that it was the pretzels and the popcorn. I never thought it was the alcohol. But I got sick, I threw up, and I passed out. And when I came to, my mother thought it was cute. She was laughing, and my father threatened to kill me. And I think it's in the chapter of We Agnostics, or it's one of the chapters that we have in our book. And right in the first paragraph, it tells me what an alcoholic is. And one is that if you can't stop when you honestly try to. And when my father threatened me, I told him I would never drink again. And I was about five. I said, I would never do, don't worry, Dad, I would never do that again. I was scared to death. And also, the other part of that paragraph says, if you cannot control the amount that you drink. If I wanted to taste alcohol, I would have just had one of those drinks. I didn't have to drink half a vase of alcohol. And that's the way I drank when I drank. I drank for effect. I remember how it made me feel. I never had those feelings unless I drank alcohol. School is a blur. I hated school. I know a lot of people love education. I hate that. And a lot of people's stories, I hated school. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't care about how many planets there were in the solar system or any of that stuff. I didn't care about any of that. The only thing I saw school was it got me out of that room. That's all I want. And I went to school, and I was put into another room. And I spent all my school years trying to get out of that room. And where I liked to be hanging out at was around school. I went to schools all in my neighborhood. I went to PS 21. I went to Owensville Junior High School. Then I got some trouble. I attribute that to alcohol. Because I started drinking at a very young age. And I was drinking with a lot of my peers, kids my own age, I was drinking with their fathers. They were winos on 220 Fifth Street. They used to hang out in front of Sawyer's Barbershop. And I loved winos. There was something about them that they could do whatever they wanted to do, and they didn't care. And I liked that attitude. And I never felt that way until I was drinking. And when I was drinking, I did what the hell I wanted to do, and I didn't care. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about my family. I didn't care about nobody. I never looked at it. I didn't care about myself. I used to look in the mirror, and I used to say it was always me and you against the world. That's how I always felt. I felt God didn't love me, and I felt my parents didn't love me, and I didn't know who these people I was living with, and I didn't want to know them. I think alcoholism is spiritual in nature. I really believe that, and what that means to me is that you can't see the love that's always around you. I couldn't see it. I lived in my own world. And I got kicked out of school, and to show you how the self-centeredness is, I remember the day that I was checking into 600 school. That's the school we got up in the Bronx. I don't know if there's anywhere else. But we have 600 schools for bad boys. And they sent me to 600 school. I remember the day I went to 600 school. I was in the trying to register for school. And I was in the front area there, whatever, in administration, and everybody started crying. Everybody was running around crying. I couldn't figure out why everybody was crying. You know, I know it wasn't because I was there, you know, but they was crying. And it came over the radio. I asked somebody what was happening. They said President Kennedy was just killed. And, you know, I couldn't care less about that. All I was worried about was me. You know, what am I doing in the school? You know, I just, like, walked right through it. And there were so many things that were, like, going on that I just couldn't see outside of me. I skipped the grade of 600 school because all you got to do in 600 school is fight. That's all it was. Fight on your way to school, fight in school, fight on your way home. I thought that was kind of boring, so I decided to go to school for a year, skipped the grade, and went to Clinton High School. I went to Clinton High School because I went to Clinton High School. You can't hear me? Is that it? Is that what he's yelling? Okay. I went to Clinton High School, and the reason why I went there because I always played basketball, and that was a good sport for me, a sport you can do by yourself. I didn't like people. I really didn't hang out with a lot of people, and I was the kind of person that you got to know me, we was okay, then you started asking me about, well, how come your name is DeLuigi, and your parents are black, and all that, and I write you off for life. You know, I write you off for life. Don't ask me no questions about me or my personal life. And what it was like a lot of fear because I didn't know the answers to those questions. I couldn't answer them. So I just decided that if you asked me anything that I couldn't answer, you'd be out of my life. I went to Clinton High School. I made the junior varsity basketball team, and I failed off the team in about 2 weeks because I used to love to sit in Missoula Parkway and drink pints of wine at record speed. And then we go behind the school and pitch pennies. And I was drunk with a pocket full of change all the time, you know. And my family couldn't figure that out. They didn't know, you know. And being that I wasn't legally adopted, I was owned by the state. So whenever I got in trouble, they'd come down in one of those cars with the little seal on the side and take me up to see the psychiatrist and the doctor and all those that kind of things. The only thing I liked about that it was always some student intern social worker who was young, pretty, and each year the dresses were getting a little higher up the room. And I used to sit in the front seat. I used to sit in the back, but now I'm like, oh, sit in the front seat, you know. And I always told them where to stop. We got to get ice cream, you know, because this trip we get ice cream, and I'll be a good boy, and all that kind of stuff. And that went on. I couldn't do nothing with me. The psychiatrist couldn't do nothing with me. I used to tell them I wasn't happy, and it was, they tried to tell me what was wrong with me, and all kind of things. I just simply told them I wasn't happy. They didn't go for that one. So, with my drinking and hanging out and coming home, and a lot of times I could only make it to the doorstop. And, you know, and in my neighborhood, the doors are left open. You could just walk in the door. I couldn't even open up the door. If I made it to the stoop, that was it for me. And at 16 or 17 years old, they told me I was either had to go wait till I was 21, go into service, or something stupid like get a job. So I decided to... because I want everybody to hear me, you know, this is like real important. So I didn't want to get a job because my father worked three of them, and I never saw him, so I figured I didn't want to work because nobody would see me if I worked, you know. So I didn't want to go away till I was 21 because I've been to 600 school and I know what that's about. So I decided to go into service, and so over a fifth of Thunderbird at Missoula Parkway, me and my friends, we all decided that we was all going to join the service. We were all going to go in on the buddy system, you know. We were going to go in and make America safe for democracy, you know. And we had to pick a branch of the service, and the only motto that we knew was join the Navy, see the world. So that made good sense to us, you know. And so the next day we was all supposed to show up at the recruiting station and sign up. And I was the only one that showed up. So I didn't like that, so I went back. We had another fifth of booze, and same thing, we'll be there tomorrow, don't worry about it. I was the only one that showed up. So I went to join the Navy, they wouldn't take me. They said the quota was filled for 6 months. I was getting ready to leave the trailer, and there was a guy down on the other end of the trailer. He was calling me down, you know, he was like waving me down. And he was a Marine Corps recruiter. And let me tell you something, I'm from the Bronx. I don't know if you're from the Bronx or what kind of person, but let me get you the headset of somebody from the Bronx. You can take me out of the Bronx, you can't take the Bronx out of me. If it doesn't happen on my block, it doesn't exist. So Vietnam and all that kind of stuff, that could have been Vic Morrow in combat on TV. No difference to me. If I didn't see it, it didn't exist. That was it. So, you know, Vietnam's going on. So anyway, the recruit is showing me pictures of boot camp, and I neglected to say that every summer my family shipped me off to camp. I think that was the highlight of their lives, I think, was packing my bags to send me off to foster kid camp. That was dreary. Everybody was from foster homes there. You hear about all that crap, you know. So every time I look forward to it. So anyway, he's showing me pictures of boot camp. So I'm thinking that it's camp, you know, camp. Camp, you know. So he's showing me pictures, and I swear, it's like I'm reading this thing. I'm looking in there, and everybody's photo, they got the right photos, because everybody in the pictures is smiling. I mean, the guys on the rifle range, they smiling. They climbing ropes, they smiling. I saw one guy, he was getting hit in the head with a pugil stick, and he had that glow about him. It just looks so nice, you know. So I said, I'll go, you know, what the hell. But I was only 17, so my family had a sign, and I knew I'd get trouble out of my mom, you know. And so I figured I'd get out of it, because my mom wouldn't go. Well, my father talked my mother into it, let him go and make him a man, let him go, because he was an Army guy, you know. So I went into the Marine Corps. I went to boot camp. I was scared to death. I didn't want to spend a lot of time. I had to go through this. I was in 17 years old. They couldn't send me to Vietnam. I went to two duty stations. I was thrown out of both of them. I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, at an Army base to train German Shepherds. First Marine ever thrown out of that school. I got drunk and thought I could drive a tractor. Never seen a tractor before, but I needed to get to Main Side to get a case of beer for the fellas. And it took me an hour to get this thing going. I couldn't stop it. I hit a truck. I'm from the Bronx. I took the weight. I got kicked out. Then I went on the Mediterranean cruise. I guess they figured they sent me on a ship with the Navy. That'll cure me out. I cannot swim. That's another story. I jumped off ship. I went AWOL in every port. In France, I met a woman. I was going to marry her. I was in love. I mean, it was the greatest time of my life. Next thing I remember, they was carrying me to the ship. Because I had gotten drunk, and I had to tell everybody where I was from, you know. They found me and put me on a ship, locked me up on the ship. I came home, and my orders was for Vietnam. I had turned 18 years old. I went to Vietnam. I'd probably still be in Vietnam today if they didn't find me and send me home. I don't talk about the war much. I was in the infantry. I got 3 Purple Hearts. I was meritoriously promoted. I did a lot. And the only reason why that happened was because I was drunk, and when the smoke cleared, I was still standing. So, thank God for alcohol. You know? Even when I got shot, you know, they want to give you morphine and all that stuff. Oh, no, just give me my canteen, you know. I used to go on the field. I used to forget my rifle. I never forgot my canteen. You know, I mean, never. Vodka for effect. And horrendous over there. Anyway, I came home from Vietnam, and everybody was in this whole big protesting thing. They was killing presidents, killing civil rights leaders. They was protesting me coming home from Vietnam. They didn't even know me. People were picketing and said baby killers and all this. And little old ladies giving me coffee and donuts and said thank you for defending our country. And, you know, I'm well, I came home, and I didn't know where to fit in again, so I decided to drink. And that's what I did. I drank. I drank on the plane coming home. Interesting experience. I'm on the plane coming home from California. The Marine Corps, they just can't go from Vietnam to New York. They got to take all these stops along the way because it's a Marine Corps, you know. I said, not me. I decided to take a plane from California straight to New York, which meant that I was not following my orders. Anyway, on the plane, the mayor of New York was also on the plane. He was coming to take over the mayorship of New York. His name was Mayor Lindsay. And I heard he was in first class. I'm sitting in standby. I don't understand that. You know, so I went up there to ask him about that, you know. And also to put in a few words that what he can do for the Bronx. You know, anyway, to make a long story short, I was handcuffed to my seat. But it wasn't so bad because I was drunk by that time, so it was fine. I've been handcuffed a lot in my life. I came home, I got out of service, I became as my mother described me, I was a bum. I had all these things going for me, I just got one job to the next. I remember one time I was living on the street, which is most of my my life after the service, and I used to go to this employment agency on 14th Street. If anybody remembers this, Louis Employment Agency. Room and board paid up in the Catskills. And what you did was you were a dishwasher. I didn't tell nobody that. I told them I was a bellhop. I was the manager of the bar. I was all these things. I was washing dishes. I never washed so many dishes in my life. You can imagine, it's like washing dishes for this place. Can you just imagine? You just come in, dishes and dishes and dishes. And I was working with these old guys, these bums, these alcoholics, you know, who got paid and didn't show up the next day, you know. Well, guess what? I got paid. I didn't show up the next day. I got drunk and I was taking the bus to the city with them. And I just went back and forth with that. My family had nothing to do with me. They didn't want nothing to do with me. I was dating a girl. She got pregnant. I didn't even know it. My daughter is the product of a one-night stand, which is ironic because I'm probably the product of a one-night stand, you know. And I didn't even know it. She was born the day I got to the Bronx. I went to my mother. She told me that this girl is pregnant. She's in the hospital having delivery as we speaking. I went to the hospital. I saw this baby. I couldn't believe it. Now, I mean, I say this in jest, but newborn babies, I don't understand them. I really don't understand how they look. They look crazy. You know, and I couldn't believe that that was my child. I could not believe that. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to kill myself. And I started a long process of rehabs and detoxes and programs, long-term, short-term, everything. And I had it wrong because I went to the program because I was a father, not because I was an alcoholic. So none of them worked out. Nothing worked out for me. And I ended up in my last days of drinking on the Bowery. A lot of stories I have. I don't have the time to tell you them all. But my family used to see me going into rehabs and programs and stuff, and they were beautiful people. They told me that if I was not drinking, I could stay there with them. And every time I checked out, I checked back home, and I used to sit in my room and say, what am I going to do? What is there to do but drink? I mean, it is boring not drinking. And so I would just tell them, I'm just going down the corner to see who's there. I'm looking for a job or something, you know. And I remember the last time I did that, I took one drink, and when I woke up, I was in Youngstown, Ohio. And the strange thing about it, it took me 4 years to get back home because I took my act on the road. And in a very short time, I was living in a house. I had a family. I moved in with a barmaid of the first bar I went to. And she had a family. It was her family. But if you ask me, it was my family. These were my kids, and I took over. You know, I mean, I took over. This is my house. And 4 years later, the Youngstown Police Department and my family were escorting me back to New York. They were putting me on the bus, and they were all waving to me goodbye. So that's how I drank. And anyway, I came back to New York, and I was ended up in the Bowery, living on the Bowery. And it's good drinking on the Bowery. All you got to do on the Bowery is find a drink a day at a time. That's what you got to do. That's all there is to do, you know. Find a drink a day at a time. And, you know, being dirty and stinky and living on the street, you take a drink and all that's okay. That is like, all right. I get a drink and I start getting high. I'm like, oh, man, this is a great life. The sun is shining. It's great. Whoa! You know, and that's it. Alcohol was like, life was like a black and white picture, and alcohol put the color to it. And it was always black and white until I drank. Okay, I walked into my first AA meeting April 1st. April Fool's Day. I was coming out of rehab. I asked somebody, isn't there a place where people go, they used to drink, they don't drink anymore? Where those words come from, I have no idea. It must have came from you people here who pray for us who are still out there drinking. But I asked that. And it wasn't a counselor, it wasn't nobody, it was a maintenance guy that said they got a place down on St. Mark's. They got a place down there for alcoholics. And I went down there and I walked into the Living Now group April 1st. That was the first group I walked into, April 1st. It was a Sunday. I walked in there on a Sunday, and I walked there. I walked 100 blocks down there. And walking was no stranger to me. I walked everywhere because I lived in the street. So when you live in the street, you walk everywhere. I walked in that meeting, and I tell you, from that day to this day, I drank no alcohol. None. Since April 1st, 1984. Thank you. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. I didn't have a spiritual awakening or any of that, but I walked in that meeting, and a guy named Frank said to me, came up to me, asked me my name, shook my hand, and said, "You never have to drink again." And I don't know if I believed him, but I believed he believed it, and I stayed. And I went from the Living Now group to the Winston group on Saturdays, to the Sobriety Unlimited group in Mount Vernon, to the Morris Park group where I'm a member of today. I became a son to my parents. I buried them both. They were from the South. I met their family, who was my family. I guess they thought I was showing up for the will and all that. But because of you and this program and the steps in this program, I had to be a son. And I'm still a son to them today, even though they're not here anymore. I met my daughter when I buried my father. 8 years of sobriety, I had to go down south to bury my father. I hated my father. My father was a disciplinarian in the house. Take me down to the basement and beat me. And if you had known me when I was drinking, I would tell you all those terrible things. But I found out in this program that sometimes people treat us the way we make them treat us. You know, they wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or something. They would have paid for my college. They would have paid for everything. And all I decided to do was drink and be a self-centered son. And so I'm not going to blame that on my father that he beat me on that, but he probably gave me what he got. He thought he could beat it out of me. And we know as alcoholics, you can't scare an alcoholic. You can't beat it out of an alcoholic, you know. Thank God for AA because I know that today. And I went down and met his family and my mom's family. And when I came back on the train, I was saying, "Well, my family's all gone after burying my father." And I got home. I sat down on my couch in my apartment, and I got a phone call. It was from my daughter's mother. And she said, "I heard you're in AA. I heard you're sober. Maybe you should try to be a father to your daughter." And, you know, my daughter's birthday was early this week. She's 22 years old. She's in the third year at John Jay. And she's a beautiful girl. I'm her father. She's my daughter. I just got finished paying 21 years of child support. That's right. That's right. You know, early in my years of recovery, when I got a job and I get that letter in the mail about the child support stuff, you know, it's time to look for another job. How can I pay child support and stay sober? I can't do that. You know, I didn't know that. You know, because they didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a sponsor. I used to go to a lot of meetings, and I'd be the guy that walk in the meeting, know everybody, and then I leave. You know, I didn't never join the group, never did all of these things. It took time for me to do that. You know, and I nailed down a job, and I said, "I'm sticking with it no matter what." They took almost all my money for that, because not only did I have to pay the monthly fee, I owed it a back money. And they just took it, and I decided to, whatever they take it because I owe it. And that's what I learned in this fellowship, in this program, about restitution, and I had to get to that step. And so I did that. And I continue to do that today. And I just met her this week. You know, I was going to come to the Bill Wilson Dinner Dance on the 26th, I think it was last year or year before, and I wanted to invite her to come with me as my my guest. And she wasn't able to come. And it would have been so beautiful to see her, but she'll be at another one with me. I can't say enough for this program, you know. The theme is singleness of purpose. And I know a lot of old-timers get a hard way to go today when people are talking about everything other than this. But if we go back to the film that we saw earlier, if we go back to the message when Bill and Bob met and they got sober together and what they said to each other was, "What are we going to do with this? What should we do?" They didn't say, "Let's go to the track and place a bet." You know, they didn't say, "Let's go buy a house," or "Let's go do this. Let's go find another alcoholic and carry this message." And I said, my role in this program is to pass it on. That simple, just to pass it on. That if you drink, there's a place where you go, you don't have to drink. And you can stay sober. And you can share something as wonderful as this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John D. A lot of identification there. A second speaker, Francine H., Pass It On Group, Staten Island. Francine.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Francine. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. For the last 3 months, I've been seriously ill. And Kenny O, our chairman tonight, kept on calling me. I was in the hospital in Boston. I had been hospitalized for kidney failure. And he said to me, "Do you think you're going to make it tonight?" And I said, "Kenny, if I have to be carried here on a stretcher, I'll be there." And and as you all can see, I didn't have to be carried in. I came back home from Boston with both my kidneys. And I'm getting better day at a time. And I have to tell you, I couldn't have done it without AA. And God bless all the people that came to my home and carried the message to me. The people held my hand. They were there for me all hours of the night. My sponsor was the last person I spoke to before I got on that plane. I was afraid to go to Boston because I was in so much agony. And I had to go to the hospital first to get checked out in the emergency room. And if I didn't have AA, I really don't think I could have did it. And that's what kept me going in the hospital. It kept me going when I came home. Kept on saying, "I'm going to come here tonight and speak at the Bill W. dinner." And it's an honor to be here. I have such wonderful friends in this program. The women in my life are remarkable. My sponsor sitting with me here tonight. All my friends in Staten Island and Manhattan, Barbara and Marie and Gina and Ruth. They've been there for me so long, and I just can't believe that tonight we're all together here, and my sponsor's doing the blessing. I had my first drink when I was 11 years old, and like John, the only place I knew was Newport Beach, Staten Island, 3 cans of Colt 45, and I drank for the effect. My intention was to get high. By the time I was 15, I was a wino. I fell in love with wine, and I fell in love with my boyfriend, Dick, who's with me here tonight. And Dick and I drank together, became great friends. We got married. I was 18 years old. It was December 1st, 1973. The same day, the woman who was to become my sponsor, Sweet Mary, was also getting married.